to the Andy Staples Show. It's a Dear Andy slash Ari edition of the show. We are going to answer some of your questions. We have not done this in a while, Ari, where we've answered the people's questions. I had one or I did it by myself, but I like to bring you in because sometimes your perspective adds a lot of flavor. And there was a question that somebody sent to me that really needs to go to you that we're going to get to at the end that might be my favorite question I've ever been asked in a mailbag. So we'll hold off on that one, but I cannot wait. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to try my best to navigate through it without losing my job. So just, you know, help me out with that, okay?
Well, we will do our best. Fortunately, it's a podcast, and we're not broadcasting it live. So if you guys hear some skips where Ari's starting, it sounds like Ari's saying the, and you think the next word is going to be most, and then the next word isn't anything like most, and it just sort of skips like we took out a whole chunk of audio. That was us trying to keep Ari employed. So just
let me ask you this, that. Andy. On a podcast, though, you have a little bit more rope than you would in the written form, right?
Yeah, probably the worst choice of words you could have thought of, but yes.
No, just a little extra slack, you know.
No, here's the thing, and this is what I try to explain to people. Everything you do reflects on you as an employee of The Athletic, whether you like that or not. And so, yes, we are supposed to be a little more irreverent here on the podcast. But that said, we have to be, you know, somewhat careful. Though I think what we're going to talk about, the statute of limitations is long past on this.
Sure.
We're in good shape.
Also, I haven't dumbed myself down at all, and I feel like people know who I am and I'm still here. So yes. I'm not that worried about it. I think I'm good. I think I'm a good
representative. I want to know, now I need to see dumbed down Ari. I can't wait to see that.
Dumbed down Ari would not be a regular on this podcast, I don't think.
All right, well, let's start. We've got some football questions to start with. One that I've been intrigued by this because I'm not sure my answer to this question, even though this program has undergone drastic changes, I'm not sure my answer to this question would be that different had it not undergone drastic changes, if that makes sense. The question is from Adam. It's, Dear Andy, what is the ceiling for the U, and can they win the Coastal this year? Now, these are two very different questions because I think the answer to the first question definitely changed with the coaching change. The answer to the second question, though, I think is probably would have been the same either way. And I think, yes, they can compete for the Coastal this year. I would have said the same thing if they hadn't fired Manny Diaz. Basically, when they figured out that Tyler Van Dyke was their guy at QB, it felt like things clicked into place for the U. It felt like Miami kind of had a sense of direction. You knew what you were going to get from them at that point. And so, yes, despite the massive upheaval, I definitely think they have a chance to win the Coastal. Ari, I don't know. Is that me saying more about the Coastal or more about Miami?
I think you're saying more about the Coastal. Wasn't this the division in college football that had seven different winners in the 7-year period?
Correct.
Including so, Duke. You know, yeah. So, you know, I think that that's part of it. The thing that stuck out to me when I read the question was, did he mean the ceiling for the U this year, or did he mean the ceiling for the U in general?
I'm going to say long term.
Because I think the ceiling for the U long term is playoff appearance.
I agree.
I went and I looked this up, and based on what we understand about Miami, and you know me being a sucker for the composite rankings, off the top of your head, if I had to ask you, like, what did you think Miami's ranking was a year ago nationally in talent
composite? This is the talent composite. This is where you know all of the players. I would say that Miami was probably number 18.
13.
Okay. Wow. All right.
And higher ranked than two of the playoff participants and playing in a conference that if Clemson is down or doesn't maintain what it has been the last 5 years, there's opportunity there. So for me, I think that when Manny Diaz gets humming, and maybe that'll be in the 2023 class or, you know, at the very latest, the 2024 class, I think Miami is going to move into the top 10 in the national composite rankings very quickly. So my question in general to the entire world of recruiting is, with all of these main figures and main coaching figures in main geographical territories, like if you go from coast to coast, you know, Florida's got Billy Napier, who's doing a hell of a job so far. Manny Diaz goes without saying who he is. That's Florida. In Texas,
you mean Mario Cristobal?
What did I say?
You said Manny Diaz.
Mario Cristobal, yes. I do this thing where I say things that aren't in my head. Do you ever do that? Where, yes. Like, I'm talking and I in my head it's correct, and then somebody be like, did you mean this? And I'm like, no, I meant what I said.
That's perfectly understandable. Manny Diaz was the coach last year, and now it's Mario Cristobal.
But both Florida schools now, and I don't know what you think about Florida State, but let's just even take Florida State out of the equation. You've got two very good coaches from a recruiting standpoint at two pillar Florida universities.
Yeah.
So recruiting Florida is going to be hard. In Texas, you have Jimbo Fisher, who just signed one of the greatest classes of all time. Steve Sarkisian, who has the Longhorns in the running for Arch Manning, and Texas and Texas A&M combined with all the other Power Five schools in that state. Texas is a very hard place to recruit now.
Right.
California, Lincoln Riley is down there in Southern California and should make it a lot harder. So, like, when you look at the natural big time cities for talent, this is like the first time in a long time. And we'd have to maybe look this up. It'd probably be a good story where there aren't any inherent outward weaknesses from a recruiting standpoint.
And Kirby Smart is at Georgia.
And Kirby Smart is in Atlanta and in Georgia.
Yeah.
So, like, what? So, in Alabama has 11 top 100 players in the state of Alabama this year, none of which Brian Harsin's probably going to get. So we'll look around and you look at all these schools that are recruiting nationally and it's like, well, where are they going to go? So that's a theory for, you know, what this means for recruiting nationally. I think I think this year could be a year where the least number of concentrated players in the top 100 go to the same five schools. Like, I'm very curious to see how that pans out.
It's true. Cause the clustering of recruits has been one of the bigger issues in terms of
the biggest issue in the entire thing.
Yeah. The lack of
solving that is more important than expanding the playoff, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And people think that expanding the playoff will resolve that. But I think getting really good, competent recruiting head coaches at the schools in the cities that have the most talent is the way to stop it. And that's happened. So the reason why I'm bringing that up, though, is because Manny Diaz, in my mind, Mario Cristobal, I cut myself. Mario Cristobal, in my mind, deserves the benefit of the doubt right now as somebody who can make recruiting Miami really, really hard. And know more than anybody how difficult it is to recruit the state of Florida. I mean, there's a lot happening in that state. It's hard. Yeah. But Mario Cristobal, in my opinion, is like the best hire that anybody could have made to do that. And everybody's always like, when's the U going to come back? What's the U? And it's just like, there's been some hope in the past, but I don't think that they've hired anybody in the last 20 years that makes you slam your fist against the table and go, they got it. So if Miami does that, I think that they have a very good chance of being a very good team again. Now, there's questions about Mario Cristobal getting the most out of his team at Oregon on the field, which, you know, if you ask an Oregon fan, they might say it's a legitimate question. But a lot of times, getting the talent is the hardest part. And in Miami, that's always been the hardest part. They had a really good class a few years ago. They made some splashes at the end of this 2022 recruiting cycle when Cristobal was only there for a month. You know, for a whole cycle, I think they're going to have a really good team. So the ceiling for them, in my opinion, would be playoff. Now, the thing that I'm interested in, and you tell me if I'm wrong, but as young quarterbacks come into schools, you know, the thing in college football is young quarterbacks want to play early, right?
Right.
And I always say, well, how did that happen? Like, what happened to wait 2 years and wait for your turn? But conversely, it's made me want to see them sooner too. So, like, as much as we talk about how Tyler Van Dyke had a pretty good year during a season in which it was supposed to be the De'Ara King show, am I the only person here just like, when is Jake Garcia going to play? You know, and like,
the thing is, Tyler Van Dyke was a freshman. Jake Garcia may play. It just may not be for Miami if Tyler Van Dyke is as good as he was at the end of last season.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And when you have a young player who played as well as he did, I understand that. But like, it was the same thing about Michigan last year. Like, why is JJ McCarthy not playing? Then they turn around and go to the playoff. And then, you know, I look like an idiot.
I am glad you said that, Ari, because it segues into our next question.
The last thing I said segue too.
Yeah. This is from Jeremy. And I answered this in the written Dear Andy column last week, but I wanted to run this by Ari because I wanted to get his recruiting perspective on it too. But I think it's interesting in this age of NIL and just in this era of college football, this question I think may have a different answer than it would have had 20 years ago. And this is from Jeremy. Do you think playing two QBs at once could be a way for program that could be a way that a program could mitigate and ultimately prevent a guy from transferring? Rather, do you think more teams could try what Michigan did last season with J.J. McCarthy and Cade McNamara? And I think this is an interesting question because I covered the team that did the two QB thing the best. I covered that 2006 Florida
team. And one of the only teams that's ever successfully done it.
Right. But that was a very specific set of circumstances where Chris Leak was a senior, understood the offense, was by far the better passer at the time. Tim Tebow was a freshman, didn't have to come in and learn the offense and be able to command the offense immediately, had a few things that was he was really good at that they had him do, and it worked great because they each gave the team something the other couldn't. Now, if Chris Leak had been a year younger and they'd won that national title in 07, it would have gotten a little tricky because at that point, Tebow's probably a good enough passer to run it on his own. Obviously, he was because he won the Heisman in 2007. But that the circumstances of that situation worked out perfectly. Rarely are you going to find such perfect circumstances, and those didn't exist at Michigan last year. But I will say, Jim Harbaugh found a way to mix in J.J. McCarthy and not in a way that was detrimental to the offense. You know, you can go back. He fumbled against Michigan State. He also had a touchdown pass against Michigan State that I'm not sure Cade McNamara could have thrown.
You're not sure? There's no way he could have made that throw.
Okay. And then you also have J.J. McCarthy as the running threat and in the Big Ten Championship game as the blocking threat. The lead block on the Blake Corum long touchdown run was spectacular.
Yeah, the thing with dual quarterback systems that's always been an issue for me anyway is, and I'm not one of these people who will just go, yeah, you don't want to tear the team apart and the chemistry and nobody knows whose team it is. Okay, that's all probably very true. I'm not a coach. But a lot of teams have a running quarterback and a passing quarterback, and they don't know how to keep the offense or the defense guessing. So it's like if you run a two quarterback system, that shouldn't telegraph your philosophy for that drive.
Correct.
And to me, I feel like that always happens where it's like, well, if Tim Tebow's in the game, maybe not Florida, that's a bad example, but if J.J. McCarthy's in the game, they might run more. And it's just like...
Yeah. Tim Tebow was only coming in on third or fourth and short.
Yeah.
And that was... So you knew...
And everybody in the world knew he was going to do it.
But you probably couldn't stop it anyway. And then they tricked you with the jump pass.
Right. But like I even covered multiple attempts at a two quarterback system at Ohio State during my time on the beat. And
yep.
It was JT Barrett and Cardale Jones. When JT was in the game, they ran the quarterback off tackle and Cardale was in, they threw it. And it was just like, it's not like JT Barrett can't throw the ball when he's in the game. Don't tell the defense what's going to happen. So like, obviously there's all these different types of things that come into play. When you're talking about a two quarterback system. And I think part of it is if you're down by a touchdown in the last minute of the game and nobody knows whose team it is, that's a problem. Okay. I buy into that. But you want to know what my answer to this actual question is?
Yeah.
My answer to my question is the teams that recruit the right way aren't going to have to worry about it. Like, I think that the answer is this is the new era of college football. If somebody transfers because they're not good enough to get on the field or they're not ready yet, that's just something that you have to live with. Because at the end of the day, the main tenet of a coach's job is to win games. Right. And I think that it's harder to win games when you're playing grab ass with your quarterback. So to me, I don't know, like J.J. McCarthy made some big plays and, you know, came up big at times for Michigan last year. There's no question about it. But to me, whenever he came into the game, it just felt like, oh, here's Jim Harbaugh making sure his quarterback doesn't transfer. And it's just like, if there's no real application for it, and I'm not saying that there wasn't an application for McCarthy. He obviously, like I said,
just made plays. That was handled better than, say, Justin Fields getting sprinkled in 2018 at Georgia.
It just seems forced, not at Michigan, but always, whenever anybody does this. And it's just like, to me, if I were the head coach of Michigan, under the circumstances of last year, coming in with half the staff changed and you getting half your contract cut from you and everybody in a win-now mode, I would have gone with the kid. And I would have let him develop into both by the time that they played in the playoff. And, you know, Michigan
but,
fans
might but be maybe this they don't guy's make the playoff. He was, maybe he yeah, makes some mistakes early that Cade McNamara wouldn't have made. Yeah,
sure. But how many close games did Michigan play this year? Not that many.
That's true.
You know, I don't know. I don't. And they lost the game that he made the biggest play in. So like,
and he also made a mistake in that game.
Sure. And they lost. So it doesn't matter. Yeah. Like they still made the playoff having lost. And the Ohio State game, it's not like Cade McNamara led the way there. Ohio State got their brains beaten. physically, and they got ran over. So you don't think McCarthy could have handed the ball off better? Like, I mean, it's the same thing. So, and then at the end of the year, when you end up inevitably playing Georgia, you have a quarterback that's physically able to do things that Cade McNamara couldn't do in a million years and has a whole season under his belt. So, like, to me, Michigan made the playoff. They won the Big Ten. They reached their mountaintop. They weren't supposed to win a national championship this year. Cade McNamara got them there, so obviously Jim Harbaugh was right.
Yeah.
But I'm always thinking of who's going to win the game when you're playing against Georgia. And I think everybody...
Yeah, but you keep bringing up Georgia. Did Georgia use the most physically gifted quarterback on its roster?
Of course not. But they had the greatest defense of all time.
Well, but maybe Stetson Bennett was the right guy for now. And look, this is what I keep telling people.
But nobody's questioning that.
If they're going to keep Stetson Bennett, what's Brock Vandegrift going to do? What's this guy going to do? They will transfer. Like, it's not that complicated. Let it happen.
Part of it is just like if they're going to transfer or you have a freshman on your team who has the temperament to leave your program after his freshman year, then there's a part of you that just can't control that. Like, they're going to have to get back to the point where players who go to a university have the understanding that it might take a year or two for them to get onto the field.
You need to find your Mac Jones or your Kyle Trask who want to say, no, I want to play here. I don't care who's ahead of me. I'll keep going and try to beat them out.
I think you want to find really, really good players who aren't going to transfer after.
Oh, you mean the two Heisman finalists I just mentioned are not good enough? The one first round draft pick who's not a starting quarterback for the New England Patriots is not good enough.
Yeah, I know. But like, if you're saying your recruiting strategy to go find a low 4-star or mid-star.
No. That's your second guy in a class. That's not your first guy.
Yeah. Yes. If you want to get those guys in, sure. If you want to go find two of the best evaluated quarterbacks in all of college football from the last decade, then yeah, I agree with you. They should go do that.
Trask is not evaluated that well. There was a little bit of the guys who did well were Randy Shannon, who found him, Doug Nussmeier,
usually
who kind of stood
Kyle
up for him.
Trask, but a recruit like Kyle Trask doesn't make it into a Florida class.
Well, and he would have transferred or gone somewhere else had Felipe Franks not hurt himself. It wasn't like they were going to put him in.
I think part of it, I think the lesson here is you can't start forcing players into games to placate their emotions in order to make sure they don't transfer when they're true freshmen. I think the idea is you have to hope that the players that you get in your program are willing to wait a year or two before transferring.
But
you know?
Keep signing them, because if they do transfer, then you'll have a highly recruited true freshman who can be your backup. And that's fine. It really is. We'll be right back after these words.
And it's like, is J.J. McCarthy not going to be Michigan's starting quarterback this year?
That's a good question. That's a great question.
Because, like, I read this question, and, like, it was always in my brain that J.J. would start this year. So, like, maybe he won't, but it's just like, what? Why wouldn't he?
It's a really good question, because this is not the Fromm Fields situation, where Fields wasn't there and Fromm took them to a national title game, and then Fields got there. They were both there. So you're right.
And Michigan's next step is to break through their ceiling. And they did that to a certain extent last year. But if you want to be really, really, really good, like good enough to beat whoever you're playing in the playoff after beating Ohio State, because they're going to have to do that again.
Right. And by the way, Ohio State has a special quarterback that Michigan may not have the elite edge rushers to terrorize this year.
Yeah, you know, so
you may have to beat them
Michigan to
playing straight
what
up.
They did,
you know,
regardless of who is that quarterback. But at a certain point, you need to hand the ball to the person who, like, I know that everybody felt good about themselves when Stetson Bennett, the former walk-on, won a national championship, and I know that you want to believe that the man who stayed at the university and loves that program,
but he didn't stay. Stetson Bennett transferred.
I'm saying in general because of like guys like Cade McNamara. Like, you want to give these people like the Kyle Trasks of the world.
Well, I think Stetson Bennett and Kyle Trask, we instead of saying, oh, holding them up as evidence of grit or whatever, we could hold them up as evidence of everybody just blew it with them. Like, they should have recognized. Like, you go back and look at Stetson Bennett's high school numbers. He was an animal in high school. Like, he was always a really good quarterback.
I do think it's so easy to say I told you so after it happened.
Of course.
It's like, how many programs blew it with Trey Lance?
All of them.
It's like, and I'll go on a 20-minute rant
right now. It's not really blowing it. But yes, it takes some imagination sometimes.
I will go on a rant right now about how insane it is that Minnesota and teams in the Big Ten up in that recruit that area didn't offer that guy a scholarship on their roster at some position.
But they did, didn't they? Wasn't he offered scholarships at other positions but wanted to play quarterback?
Now, he might have.
That's where you play the old recruiting bait and switch where you go, oh, yeah, we'll give you a chance to play quarterback.
Here's my theory. If this guy is what he is from a physical standpoint, which I'm going to look up his recruiting profile right now because he did have okay offers, I believe, coming out of – I mean, he was the 2,000th rated player. But if you have a guy who's 6'4", 200 pounds coming out of high school, who has a Boise State offer and can throw the ball a mile in the air – and he wants to play quarterback, like, why wouldn't Minnesota just be like, okay, we'll roll the dice on you. And either you turn into something great and you change our program or you transfer. It's like not that big of a risk to take a physical specimen who is in that area of the country and like throw the dice on him. He's from Minnesota, right? Like right. How he didn't end up at like Wisconsin or Minnesota or Iowa or any of the teams that are up there. Recruiting that area to me blows my mind. I know North Dakota State obviously is one of the better programs at that level, but it's just
the best program at that level.
Yeah. So why not just, I just feel like I would be more liberal with gambling with my scholarship spots if I were at a program that could be altered by having a game changing quarterback talent.
Especially if it's a player, if it's a quarterback who you're confident could play another position at your level. Which Trey Lance, coming out of high school, you would feel comfortable if you had to switch him to another position. He could contribute to your program.
And if he didn't want to do that, he could leave, which would then give you your scholarship back that you were afraid to risk.
Right.
He played basketball and football, and he also played safety. You know, and I know most, but like, it'd be very interesting to go back and talk to some people from that class. Be like, what did you see that made him the 2000th player? Was he rough? Was he not very good? Like, what was the – because, like,
I think the offense didn't help, too. I think he might have been in an offense where he didn't get to show off very much. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons. It's like Justin Herbert –
I was right, Andy. He had no Big Ten offers.
Yeah. Justin Herbert didn't get much run and really was only offered at the very end by Oregon because he was local. Scott Frost, I think, was pounding the table for Dylan Gabriel. Or, for Mackenzie Milton. Wrong Hawaiian, but we wanted Mackenzie Milton for that spot. And they're like, no, we got to take the kid from Eugene. Herbert, all it was, he just didn't go to the camps. Like, he was too busy playing other sports. So,
yeah, I think the moral of the story is two things. One, gamble on underrated players that are physical specimens. And two, recruit good enough where you don't have to worry about people transferring and you just know that you'll get another one.
Yeah. And that's what I hate to say this because I know people don't want to hear this and it annoys them because it's not the college football they grew up with. But that's I have friends who root for different teams and the most angst I ever hear from them is, oh no, is this quarterback going to transfer? And I'm just like, yeah, of course he is. Why do you care? You have a decent starting quarterback. And they're like, but this guy might leave. And like, so you'll sign another one next year.
Yeah. I think like the perfect example of it is what Ohio State did this year.
Yeah. Exact. Quinn Ewers. Who cares that he left?
Yeah. He left. Like, okay. Well, you know, and maybe he'll go win the Heisman of Texas and be the first overall pick in the draft in 2 years. But you know, you bring him into the program, you do your best to coach him up. He wasn't ready to play. So he didn't play. I think he had a handoff at the end of a game at the end of the year. And if he just still wants to leave or decides he made a mistake, then you have to live with the consequences of that.
Yeah. If somebody wants to, I told you so because you kept CJ Stroud, because you stuck with CJ Stroud, you're fine. You're good.
Yeah. And it's like sometimes you let somebody go because you don't have a choice. It's not because you don't believe they'll be good. Like, I think that I have every confidence in the world that Quinn Ewers is going to be awesome. Also, he's on my favorite team. So, second favorite team behind USC, by the way. You know, maybe he'll be great, but like he wasn't even at Ohio State long enough to make that evaluation.
Yeah. And the fact that he left the way he did, I think that says something too. So,
I don't know.
It gives me less confidence about what will happen at Texas. Let's just say that.
Does it really?
It does.
Well, kid's from Texas. He goes to Ohio State.
I know. Money, he was going to go to Texas originally. I got it.
Yeah. Like, wait, you don't think he's going to be good now? Because he changed his mind or made money early? But, like, I just feel like that's what a lot of people do. At an Ohio State fan will kind of rationalize, well, that's not a big deal that he left. And the fact that he left means that he's weak and not a good leader. It's like, no, it's probably he's just very good and wants to play sooner and would rather be in Texas.
And that may be the case. Ohio. I mean, Justin Fields obviously did that and made the right decision.
And how many people in Georgia probably said, yeah, well, he obviously doesn't want to compete against the best.
Not many. They were busy piling on Kirby Smart for picking Jake Fromm.
You know what people say about transfers. Yeah. And it is interesting because I wonder how long it will take in this new world of college football transfers, like the normalization of quick transfers, before the stigma of transfers goes away. Because there still is a stigma.
I don't think it'll be long. And that's a great segue into the next question.
Buddy, I'm so glad you did this. Yeah.
This is from Robert. Is Moneyball possible in college football? The TV revenue the SEC and the Big Ten will make in the near future will turn those teams into the New York Yankees of the 60s and 70s compared to the rest of the Power Five and especially the Group of Five. We know that all that currently exists, but the gap will be just much larger and those programs should just throw their hands up and quit trying in the hopes of a national championship. Will we ever see a day where a school making $20 million less than these powers, which, by the way, it'd be more than that. It's 20 million, you know, it's going to be like 30 or 40 million less on your conference disbursement. It's going to be like 60 or 70 million less total. Can beat more talented / richer teams through analytics and recruiting and in game. And you see schools already trying this. Example, Dave Aranda's analytical approach. The blue chip ratio remains undefeated, but could we get a head start on one hell of a movie if it happens? Okay, here's the thing. Moneyball, the A's didn't win a World Series, by the way. So, As great a book that Michael Lewis, you know, Michael Lewis's book was amazing. Did they make the World Series? Did they make the playoffs? The Rays made the World Series twice doing it. So they didn't win, but they made the World Series. The Royals won the World Series. So
is that makes perfect sense to me, the baseball version of it. And I don't know if everybody knows what Moneyball is, but
it's more statistically based.
It's more statistically based. And honestly, it's a team sport, but it's a very individual sport.
Correct.
It's one-on-one a lot of the time.
It's a lot, yeah. So your pitcher versus batter matchup. Yeah.
And if you can find somebody who has tremendous value based on their statistics and some of the more not obvious statistics, like they went deeper than RBIs and batting average. I mean, they went on to like
they basically uncovered what statistics truly matter. Like this sounds like common sense, but until they started doing it, it wasn't common sense in the game. Like getting on base really matters a lot. Like however you do it.
Nobody was getting huge contracts at the time for having great on base percentage.
Right. Exactly.
And they just wanted home runs. And it was like wasn't this like right around the time where home runs were like sexy again? And
yeah, it was steroid era. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So like, I understand that. It's just like, to me, when somebody and I've heard this before, I've heard a question like this before. And like, I don't know. I think there's a question before answering the question, and that question is, what does Moneyball in college football look like?
Well, I think like, to me, all what Moneyball means, is having a great evaluating staff,
which is,
and we've seen that. Like Wake Forest, Dave Clawson is Billy Beane.
Yeah.
Will that win him a national championship? I don't know, but it got him to the ACC championship game, which if you look at what Wake is up against versus the rest of its division.
Every realm, yeah.
It's pretty freaking amazing that they won that division.
Yeah, it's like throw up their hands and hope and quit trying their hopes of a national championship. It's just like that's the difference between college football and professional football too. And I make this mistake when evaluating things sometimes myself. But Wake Forest's goal wasn't to win a national championship. Like if they would have won their conference, that would have been a national championship. So like the Oakland A's were trying to win a World Series with everybody else, but the underlying definition of success varies from program to program in college football. So that changes things a little bit. But like the idea of being a tremendous evaluator and finding diamonds in the rough already exists at the college level. And you're seeing certain programs transcend, you know, like Northwestern's another example. It's like somebody asked me in a mailbag a few weeks ago, which programs, in your opinion, are the best examples of getting the most out of the least? And like, which ones come to mind? I mean, Wisconsin came to mind.
Yep.
Because they've only signed one top 25 recruiting class in the history of the program. and all their success came before that. Northwestern comes to mind. Wake Forest came to mind. Iowa State certainly came to mind.
Oh yeah,
you know, there's guys out there. So it's like, is Iowa like a really good moneyball program, for lack of a better term?
I think so. Iowa's great at producing offensive linemen, tight ends. They've kind of found their niche. And like, and here's my thing. Like, if you're a good high school tight end, and this doesn't necessarily happen, like Brock Bowers went to Georgia, but like, shouldn't the best high school tight end go to Iowa? Like, who's more likely to turn you into a first rounder?
Yeah, I know. Well, actually, I have a mailbag question this week of, and maybe you, it's, I have to like look things up, but it said, if you were a recruit at the, and you were the best recruit at each position, which school would you go to at every position? Which I thought was a very interesting.
If I was a tight end, I'd go to Iowa.
Iowa or Notre Dame.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. If you were an offensive tackle, would you go to Wisconsin?
I certainly would think about it. I would think about it.
Or very Bama. Hard. No, I would just go to Bama at every position.
Right. With offensive tackle, Alabama runs an offense that looks like an NFL. Actually, probably looks the most like an NFL offense now because of all the different things they can do. So I think playing O-line for Bama would be the best preparation you'd get.
Wouldn't the actual answer just be Alabama for everyone?
No. Like the tight end thing, Iowa's a very, like specifically the way they use the tight end and the way they use the tight end relative to how NFL teams use the tight end, I think that makes them an obvious choice.
Yeah. I'm looking back at Alabama's NFL draft history. I'm trying to see where their tight ends get drafted.
OJ Howard was a first rounder, though underused at Alabama, most people would say.
Yeah. Irv Smith.
So another one. Irv Smith was used very well at Alabama and developed very well at Alabama.
OJ Howard. Yeah.
But like, I can't say Brock Bowers made a mistake. Brock Bowers is the most explosive skill player Georgia has and will be the centerpiece of the offense going forward.
Yeah, for sure. Iowa had two first round draft picks at tight end in the same year, didn't they?
Fant and Hawkinson. Yeah.
Yeah. And both of them are really good in the NFL.
Yeah. And then Kittle was, I would say, probably underutilized at Iowa. And then that, you know, when all that stuff came out about the strength coach and the weight room and mm-hmm. what they said to NFL scouts, it sounds like Kittle kind of got talked down by those folks.
And yeah, I think it's working out.
Drafted higher.
Yeah. Interesting question, though, for sure.
It is.
You want a coach who can evaluate really, really well, and you want to do the thing about this that I'll close on, and then we can move on. Is there seems to be this thought process that the Matt Campbells of the world and the Pat Fitzgeralds of the world are like the only really good evaluators. And no. The thing that people don't consider is the really good teams that you're trying to beat in Moneyball are also really good evaluators.
Right.
So Kirby just because
Smart saw a three-star Jordan Davis and envisioned what he could be. Nick Saban. I remember Nick Saban telling the story about Josh Jacobs where he sends, I forget which assistant it was, he sends to Tulsa, but he basically goes, figure out what's wrong with this guy because everything we see on tape says this guy's a star and he doesn't have any offers. So figure out what's wrong. Well, it turns out there wasn't anything wrong. People had just blown it with him. And then all of a sudden, Alabama offers and everybody else around him is like, oh, yeah, well, no, we'll take you too.
Yeah.
So it
insane.
Yeah, well, that's the problem is, the guys who win national titles, Nick Saban, Dabo Sweeney, Kirby Smart, great evaluators too. They just happen to get the five stars as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're not just going to beat them because you out-evaluated them.
No, they're going to have the guys that everybody thought was great. And then they'll also find that one or two extra that come in and then just kill you. That's when Josh Jacobs comes in and destroys you. Yeah, It's a little, you know, it's unfair. Life's not fair. That's the way it is. But no, Moneyball exists in college football, just not in the way that Robert is talking about, because it is probably prohibitive to think that such a program could win a national title just because they are up against so much. But I would argue, like Wake Forest, look at what Wake Forest is up against in its own division with Clemson and Florida State. And look, Louisville's got money. Louisville has talent. Like NC State, they've got money. They've got talent. Like it's hard and they did it. So you got to take your victories where you can get them in the
Moneyball. The funniest thing about college football, too, is that if you're really good at Moneyball and it actually works, you get hired at another job where you absolutely have to not do Moneyball anymore.
No, exactly. Exactly. Then you just money whip. Like you.
Then you
just
money whip.
Yeah. It is coupons. Funny how that works. Yeah. Ideally, you bring, and that is what Nick Saban and Dabo Sweeney and Kirby Smart do. They bring the concepts that work with Moneyball. Like, I'm sure Kirby Smart learned quite a bit at Valdosta State about finding diamonds in the rough that he has since transferred to Alabama and Georgia. So, now we get to
our players that are on that roster are Moneyball players on top of all the high contract home run hitters.
They had a walk on starting on that defense. It's crazy.
Wear those rings, dogs. You earned it.
We'll be right back after this message from one of our lovely sponsors. All right, Ari, this is my favorite mailbag question ever, and it really wasn't addressed to me. It's more to you. This is from Justin, who's clearly a podcast listener as well. After hearing that Ari Wasserman helps his buddies write texts to romantic interests, what are Ari's best opening lines? So I feel bad because we didn't explore this enough when it came up on the podcast a few weeks ago, that you are essentially the Cyrano de Bergerac of the Tinder era. And you didn't even know who Cyrano de Bergerac was, which I find hilarious. It's a very famous play where there's a guy and he's ugly. He's got a big, nose. He's an ugly guy. But he is very thoughtful and intelligent and suave. But he's in love with this girl, and so is his best friend. And the best friend is good looking, but not nearly as, smart or engaging as Cyrano. And so Cyrano agrees to feed the best friend lines so that he can woo this woman. And so if you want a more modern take on it, the Steve Martin movie Roxanne, same deal.
Okay.
So now that's basically, you are helping these people. You are feeding them the lines. How did this work? How did this come to be? How do your friends figure out, all right, let's have Ari tell me what to send this lady on? I'm assuming this is this Tinder? Is this Match?
Hinge, okay. Bumble, Tinder, whatever they need. Okay. I'm their guy. Right. I don't know how to say this without being arrogant or to sound
be arrogant.
I am very good. One of my talents has always been I'm very good at talking to women. And I think part of the reason why is because I've never been one of these people, for better or worse, that's been afraid of rejection. And I'm not saying
huge key. Huge.
And I'm not saying that I would go in and like any girl I talked to would like me.
No.
But if a girl didn't like me, it rolled off my back and then I moved on.
It didn't crush you. Whereas I was the opposite. Like I tried to psych myself up with, well, all she can say is no to a date, and that's
which
not
is true.
But it was the end of the world to me. Like, so that's like, how why? I felt.
Like, I still don't understand. Like, whenever I have friends that are afraid, it's just like, what does it
means
matter?
You're good enough or whatever, however you want to put it.
Celebrities and get divorced. Dude, everybody's not good enough for somebody.
I know. As I was telling you over text earlier today, like the reason I talked to my wife wasn't because I was super confident and walked up to her. It was ladies' night. $2 Long Islands, and she'd had a few of those $2 Long Islands, and she came and talked to me. Like that's how that started. I would have been too intimidated to talk to her.
To knock myself down a peg, in my entire life, regardless of where I was physically, I've never had a girl come up to me and like throw themselves at me. Like any girl I've ever gone out with.
She wasn't throwing
girl
herself at me. I think it was more that I was trying to entertain her and her friends while my friend talked to one of their friends. So
you were the
I was the wingman.
Yeah, you were the wingman. Okay.
By the way, no, our producer Camelina, much more modern pull here in terms of what you are. This is Hitch. You're Will Smith. Your buddies are Kevin James. Except
Hitch would have been a very funnier movie if Kevin James was the coach and Will Smith was the nerd, in my opinion.
Hitch would have been Cyrano de Bergerac or Roxanne if that had been the case.
If Kevin James were the date doctor and a good-looking, charming, handsome man was for whatever reason like Kevin James's personality, and you had Kevin James was the guy who... Like, I think that I'm Kevin James. You're right.
That would have been a better... I'd watch, I would have enjoyed that because I didn't really like it.
Because that's how King of Queens happens. You know? That's how King of Queens happens. And, you know, I'm not going to toot my own horn here, but I think my future wife is a rocket. So, like, and I'm proud of that. You know? I think she's beautiful. And so, basically, what happened was, like, back in the day, it's like when we were 20, 25 years old, and the dating apps were basically the only real way to, you know, line up dates in the middle of the week. Like, I'd have friends over at my house or whatever, and like you'll ask Doug LaMaurice, one of my old colleagues, and Bill Landis, but like we used to record an Ohio State podcast back in 2015 called Buckeye Talk. And I used to swipe on Tinder in the middle of the pot. Like, if I were single right now, I would be swiping on Tinder while doing the podcast. And it used to annoy the heck out of Doug. He'd be like, can you just concentrate on the show? Like, can this wait? Like, and I would just like I would swipe all day, every day. I would never stop. And I'd have like 20, 25 conversations going on at once because there's so many, and like you're in different cities matching with people all over the place.
This is amazing to me. So the last time I was single was 2000. Like, none of us sent text messages in 2000. Social media didn't exist. The iPhone wouldn't be invented for 7 more years. And basically, if you did online dating, it meant the person was probably going to chop you up into little pieces.
The single people that I know now, if it weren't for the apps, don't meet people. It's like now I don't even know how people met people.
I would have been so much more confident on these apps though, because I'm decent at writing stuff. So
I'm great at it. So that's so that was what would happen. Like all my friends would just be like, hey, and I'd be sitting next to him like, you can't come up with anything. Hey, what's up? You can't come up with anything.
Chilling, playing some COD with the
boys.
So like
I did all sorts of things. So like when somebody says, what was his favorite pickup line? I didn't have like, hey, did it hurt falling from sky to the angel? You know, like all that stuff. Like I tried to be unique. Like, for instance, like I was always trying to be uniquely funny. And, you know, for instance, when one beautiful woman that I went on a date with when I was 25 had a picture with her and her grandma as her main picture. And I would message her, hey, are you the right or the left? Like something funny like that. Like I'm confused about whether
that sounds like something from the pickup artist. Like, what do they call it? Negging?
And it wasn't a neg, because then she'd be like, laugh out loud. That's funny. I'd be like, I'm sorry. I can't tell. But if that's your grandma,
if she's incredibly beautiful, she's had a million people tell her she's beautiful.
Yeah.
But and it's very few bring the grandma into the equation.
You don't have to acknowledge to a pretty girl that she's pretty. She knows she's pretty. Yeah. So like if you bring the grandma into the equation, then she like the key is always to get the first response. And that's something completely different. Are you the right or the left? And, you know, she says like, ha, 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 very funny. And I'll say like, yeah, well, at least it means that you're going to age well or something nice. Like you're going to be.
Oh, and you compliment the grandma.
Yes.
Dude, and you are playing chess while everyone else is playing checkers.
And like I could be like, I would say something like. And sometimes I'd have like pickup lines, but I, you know, like, hey, can you get me in the number to your lawyer? And they'll be like, what are you talking about? I'd be like, your lawyer. And like, I play it off like on 3 or 4 responses. And they'll say, I don't have a lawyer. And I'll say, well, then how did you get out of prison after murdering that dress? Like something like that.
Whoa. That's pickup liney right there. Liney. Okay, that's very pickup liney.
I had my friends send me a few of my old, I read the question.
Yeah.
And you told me to try to figure some of these out. So let me go find this.
I've got one that you sent me that I'll do the dramatic reading of it.
Go ahead. You do
between one of your friends and someone named Lacey. And Lacey, very attractive young lady. And so your friend opens with action, and I'm not kidding.
And I took over after that. I'm good. What are you up to?
Yeah.
This wasn't me.
The first line that he opens with is fine because everybody thinks it's a stupid generic thing, but it's probably the best opening you can get. Hey, how are you? Lacey, hey, smiley face. I'm well. How are you? Friend, I'm good. What are you up to? Lacey, working on a paper. What about you? Friend, that sucks. What's it about? I don't think Ari's taken over yet. I think we'll find out when Ari takes over. Here's Lacey's response, at which case, it's very clear the friend is out of his league. Because I mentioned, Lacey, very attractive young lady. It's a psychodynamic case formulation, so I'm conceptualizing a client using psychodynamic theory. Quite interesting, actually. And then that smiley emoji with the sweat coming, the one bead of sweat coming down. I don't speak emoji. I'm not sure what that means. But Lacey sounds kind of awesome at this point.
Yeah, and my buddy wanted to write back, wow, that sounds super fascinating. Like, tell me more about it. And I was like, dude, just be witty and funny and get to the point. Like, you know what I mean?
And so here's Ari. This is the buddy with the line fed from Ari. Want to conceptualize me sometime next week at dinner?
And they went out.
Did they ever conceptualize? Do we know?
They went out. I don't know if they conceptualized, but they went out. So basically what I do, though, is I like try my best to be clever and engaging and not creepy, because honest to God, I have like Britt has a lot of single friends and I like read their messages too.
I'd be terrified.
Guys are really, really like horny. Like, there's no other way to put it. Like, they say things, true. You know, it's true, but it's like, go on Twitter, like go look at every response from an attractive reporter. Like, there's a million responses of people are just like, oh my God. And like the emojis and like yeah. the gifs. It's just like, that's not the way to talk to a woman. Like, it's just not, you know? And I don't know if I don't want to like call myself Hitch, but like, I do feel
you
like
are.
I'm here.
This is a movie, Ari.
I'm very,
yeah, we already have the sitcom where you play my wacky neighbor, but this is a movie.
Yeah. There's another one on here. So my buddy went out with this girl named Sonia.
Mm-hmm.
And it went poorly when they went out. And then they matched on a different app again. And she
so this
wrote
is like,
to him.
This is like the app version of the Pina Colada song, essentially.
I don't even know why they're going out again or why they matched again. But they matched again. And she wrote to him, David, which is his name. You know damn well we have zero chemistry. We already tried this already. And I said, like, wow, that's the funniest opening message I've ever gotten on here. And then they went out again.
How'd it go?
Terribly. So like, that's the thing too. It's just like, I always say, like, I'll go like the first 10 or 15 messages if you want, but then you have to take the wheel, because if you go to dinner and you're like nervous and not funny, then it's not going to match. So like, you have to like be very like, I don't know, like funny.
I can
and,
just
I
imagine
know, like borderline.
I can imagine
arrogant.
there's some, you know, 25-year-old woman at dinner with one of your friends. And she's like, so tell me all about this filet of fish obsession. And the guy's like, what? I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. You know, and there's guys on here that are just like super good looking and have a six pack and are just like, hey babe, you want to go come over or you want to go out to dinner? And it's just, that works for them. But it's like, for people like us, like me, like I had to,
oh, I know I've been,
I mean,
there.
Like if you ask Britt to this day, it'll be like, what do you think is the best thing about Ari? She'll be like, he can make me laugh, you know? And like, that to me is the most important thing. So like, I always talk to people with, I never talked to people who, I guess, quote unquote, were out of my league. And, you know, we talked about this when Britt and I got engaged, but everybody was like, dude, you outkicked your coverage. And I was just like, that was really nice, I guess, but also kind of sucks because, like, you don't want to feel that way. But Britt was always way more attractive than I was. But whenever I was with her, I never treated her differently than I would have, like, a friend or a person I cared about. You know what I mean? You just talk to them like they're people.
That's called being a decent human being. Like, that's just how you're supposed to treat people. And
if you're on Twitter and some girl's on there and you're like, hey, you want to go out tonight? Or, hey, you want to come over? And, like, do it in a creepy way? Like, when has that ever worked in the history of the world?
I can't imagine that. Like, I don't know. Again, I haven't been single in so long. I wouldn't even know where to start. But, like, the idea of sliding into someone's DMs to ask them out seems super creepy.
Oh, I mean, I've done everything. But like, you have to do it in a way that's not, because like in 2020 and 2015 and 2017, these dating apps are very well accepted. You know, like it's just the way it is. So there would be times that I would be on the dating apps and I wouldn't match with a person, but they list their Instagram and I'll send them a message on Instagram so I could talk, because that's the best part of who I am. Like, let me talk to you. And sometimes they would not respond because maybe that is creepy, but sometimes they'd be like, hey, I don't really look at that app anymore. I'm happy you messaged me. And it's like, It's not like it was in 2005 when Facebook just started. Like, communicating with girls online is super normal and mainstream now.
Well, that's what I think it. I appreciate that with these apps, everybody can kind of set the ground rules and say, here's what I'm here for. Here's what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
And I think that makes everything easier because that takes a lot of pressure off both parties.
And you don't have to, like, just talk to people like they're people. And you know what's so funny? And I think about this all the time. But in this world, like, if you got my dad talking about Facebook, because my dad is one of those people who doesn't have Facebook. And my mom is that 60-year-old
people.
Yeah. And my mom is one of those 60-year-old women who have Facebook, who post everything.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how a 60-year-old woman is on Facebook. Like, it's like dinner and drinks with friends. Huh? You know what I mean? It's like out for a walk. Like, everything is like a post. And my dad will go on like a 15-minute rant about like how Facebook and social media is ruining society and how like nobody has any outlets anymore and everybody's so concerned about what people are having for dinner. And my dad's like, I don't give a shit what anybody had for dinner. I'm more concerned about my dinner. And like, it's funny. But like, when you think about technology in the world of dating and like how much trust we put into strangers as a result of it now, like, there is a certain element of trust that people didn't have 20 years ago that they have to have now. Like, I'm in Phoenix right now visiting my parents, and I had to get in the car with a stranger who took me to the airport.
Who drove you? Right.
Who drove me to the airport. And it's like,
but the taxi driver, driver 30 years ago was a stranger too.
Yeah. But the taxi driver worked at a company.
Right.
That
employed, you know, drivers.
Drivers. So it's a little bit. So like, to me, it's like, this stranger could have driven me anywhere. And it's like, you don't even think twice about it. And I think that there's a certain element of having inherent trust in people, you know, at least preliminary, that you wouldn't have had 15 years ago. So like, if I ever send somebody a message and they never responded, that was it. Like, you never, you know, that's over. Yeah. Like, you don't keep going. But I tried everything I could to say things that were witty, but also not creepy, because there is a line between witty and creepy.
Right.
Oh, my 100%. Friends will come over and they'll be on the apps, even girls. I'll do it for.
That's.
Yeah, because like, I know what they like. And
I just
start
messing with the dudes at that point. Whoever they're talking to.
Dudes are very easy to mess with, but you know, it's just like, find somebody who will treat you with respect, but also find somebody who's even moderately interesting. Because if you can't be interesting over text, then how are you going to be interesting?
No shot. This is true. And so, but what I find interesting is, you know, with all this, and you had a lot of, you know, success meeting people with these apps. That's not how you met Britt.
That's the funniest thing about it. Yeah. And I don't know. Like, I mean, I know people. I know a girl right now that met some guy on what's the Hinge. That's the serious one. Like, each dating app is like, Tinder is a hookup app. Mm-hmm. Bumble is the app where the women have control. And that's much cleaner because the women open the conversation. And then Hinge is like it's basically like eHarmony, but swiping.
Trying to find somebody.
Finding love. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think based on what app you're on, that in and of itself is a message of what you're looking for. So they met on Hinge like a month ago or 2 months ago, and like, they are seeing each other 4 times a week and like are crazy about each other already. And it's like, maybe they'll get married. I think a lot of people find their partners that they're going to marry. But to me, like, in 2016, I weighed like 210 pounds. I was hitting the gym. I had the toughest fade in the Midwest. And like, I was like a young single, like I went out every night, like covering Ohio State. And it's like a perfect town for that because I lived on High Street, but also was removed from campus and was where all the young professionals lived. And I lived within like a 3-minute walk of like the bars that everybody went to. Like, in 2016, that summer 16 was the best summer of everybody's life for some reason. That was just a great summer. I went on like 4 dates a week. Like, I would line them up Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And sometimes they would go great and sometimes they would be terrible, but there was never any worry because if I was having an awful time or they didn't like me or there was no connection, all I had to do was pay the tab and walk home 5 minutes and I was in my living room. Like, I didn't go out. So like, if you're in a situation where you're within walking distance of social bar scene, like, it's an awesome way to meet people. And I met some people on there that I'm just friends with now to this day that I'm just met randomly. So here's the biggest issue. And it's like, funny, this is like, last week we talked about how to get into shape, but this week we're talking a little bit about like relationship advice, I guess, or like dating advice. But like the hardest thing about being a 34-year-old man now is making new friends, like male friends.
Yeah.
Like that to me was much harder than ever finding a girl, because there's no like, and I know Bumble did like that friends thing where you swiped on friends, which is just weird.
That sounds.
But it's like, how does a 34-year-old man who works in an industry where all of his colleagues live in different states,
well,
meet
you,
other men?
You want to know how? I'll tell you how. Here's how that works. Your kid will go to school, and you will meet the other parents. That's exactly how you make friends at this age.
It has been hard. Like moving, all my friends are in Arizona, California, and the East Coast, New York and Boston.
Yeah.
So like when I moved to from Ohio, like Bill Landis was like the only social friend that I had in Ohio, really, because I didn't have any of my college friends. And you know how important college and high school friends are to the rest of your social scene, because like those are the people that stick with you for a long time.
I'm the same way. I don't live in the town with most of those people. I think there's one of my high school friends lives near me, and you know I've lived in this town for continuously for 18 years now, but for most of that I was on the road like 150 days a year, so I wasn't hanging around people here. But I've made more friends locally in the last 3 or 4 years because my kids go to school with other kids, and you just sort of end up hanging out with the parents, and the parent groups kind of split off like, oh yeah, you're fun to hang out with, so we're going to hang out socially. And that's how you will make friends going forward.
You hang out with people who are in similar situations with you who also have a kid, which I'm finding. But like moving to Texas, all the male friends that I have are male friends that are dating or married to Brit's friends.
Yeah.
But like we don't live in it. We don't work in an environment where you're going to an office every day with 100 other people who are your age that you can meet. And then it's like hard to have a social branch. Mm-hmm. So like I've struggled with like, who's the guy, if I want to just gamble on a Kentucky basketball game on a Wednesday night,
who would you
and
call?
I want to go to a bar and watch a game and have dinner and have a beer or two with a friend, like who do I call just to shoot the shit with for an hour? And it's like, that's a hard thing to do. So and like talking to other dudes is hard, you know, like, or like at least how do you become, it's like that I love you, man. It's like, how do you make friends?
Yeah. It's like, no, it is hard because it's like, there's not a really good way to do it. There's not a really good way to figure out if you're compatible as a friend.
And you have to have really good compatibility with the male friend.
Yeah.
Like Landis and I talk all the time about everything. Like if I see any, like I just like, I could sit in a room with Landis for 3 hours and never feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And just like exist, you know, and I think that's part of it too. It's like, you don't have to feel like the, maybe I'm just saying I'm in love with Landis. I don't know. I don't know if that's what I'm saying. Be.
And that's okay. Listen,
he just got married last week too.
I saw the pictures. It was beautiful. I met her, a little over a year ago at the national championship game. So
yeah,
happy for them, but I don't think she's going to take him away from you. I think you guys will still have the bromance and everything will be fine.
Yeah. Yeah. But it is a kind of funny thing to think about. It's like, oh, how do you date? It's like dating is so easy because dating is a bunch of going out with people you don't know at all and that being perfectly acceptable. Like making a friend, you have to like enough to just want to hang out with.
Well, and I would argue that finding the person you want to live with the rest of your life, the person you want to marry, the person when you have kids with, is very close to the same thing. Like, is this a person you can be friends with the rest of your life?
Sure.
Like that's the key to the relationship. Like it blows my mind because, you know, like you meet a lot of other couples once your kids get into school. How many couples who've been together a long time don't even seem to like each other very much?
That's sad.
And like Ann and I, we have the same, we don't have the same tastes and everything, but we are just friends. Like we get along really well. We have, you know, all the same inside jokes. We have, you know, we speak in movie quotes, that sort of thing. It's just little stuff like that. And it is strange how much that dynamic changes when you can tell the couple they're not actually friends. It feels more like a business arrangement.
Sure. Like to me, and I'm not even married yet. Like you're the master of this, but like, I want to run errands with Brit. Like
absolutely.
I have fun with her.
I like hanging out with Ann. She's, she's more fun than most of the other people I know, which is why I married her.
And I don't know what your scenario was when you met Anne, but like when I met Britt, it was like unquestionable, like somebody that I was like, I was crazy about.
Yes. Like we got engaged after 3 months. So
yeah,
if that tells you anything.
Yeah. So you get it. It's like, I went on a lot of dates and I had a lot of fun with a lot of people. Some people I didn't have fun with, but even people that had great dates with, like there was a feeling that just wasn't there. But like when you meet the person you're supposed to marry, I firmly believe that there is a inherent connection that
exists
naturally that doesn't exist with just like, hey, I had fun with that person at this bar that one time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll try to get some more transcripts because this has been going on for years and
we're just going to do dramatic readings and I'm going to pretend all your friends talk like this and just like, sup, yo, what's up, baby?
And I guess it was kind of like, it was kind of pickup liney at times too. Like,
I'm going to start. I was hoping you'd come to that realization after I read that example.
The one thing I will say is I didn't have generic pickup lines for everybody where I could just cut and paste it to anybody. Like right. I always used something from their profile.
Best spoke is always the way to go, Ari.
Like somebody said like one of their favorite things in the world was Pokemon. And I said, I really like Pokemon too. How else could I get a Pikachu?
Worried you were going to go Squirtle there. So I'm glad you went to Pikachu.
No, I didn't go Squirtle. I don't even know what Squirtle is. But
it's the little Andy, turtle.
I said I didn't want to get fired. So
it eventually evolves into Blastoise.
So. Yeah. Yeah. I always try to make them laugh based on something that they can relate to. And that always works. And maybe a lot of my friends just don't know how to text. I don't know. The texting
it's so is like, stupid, but I bet it worked.
It did. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Plumbing the depths of your psyche never ceases to amaze me. We're going to write this script.
Better than you thought it was going to be?
It was. We're going to write the script. Camelina is also going to get a writing credit on this thing, too. For pointing this out, but we are definitely going to write kind of the reverse hitch where you're going to be the coach and some, you know, just chiseled jaw, six pack dude comes to you needing your advice. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Like I'm arrogant. So I think that I could be the recruiting coordinator at U of A. I've said that on this podcast before.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
I do think that if I sat down with random like group texts with your friends. Like there are so many things that are just so unquestionably hilarious to me that if you were to write them down in a notepad, like just existing, maybe this is how Seinfeld made Seinfeld. And obviously he's a comedian.
Larry David helped.
Yeah. Yeah. Larry David. But like a lot of that stuff was like real life things that they noticed just in their regular lives. I think that if I compiled all the things into a Word file of all the things that make me laugh on a given week over the course of the last 5 years, that we could use those to make a really funny pilot, or we could use those to make a very funny movie. Here's the problem though.
Okay.
Those movies don't exist anymore.
No. You need some pre-existing. We could make an indie though. We don't need the pre-existing IP.
Like,
we don't
really
need
truly good comedies don't exist anymore.
The hitch, which wasn't really an original concept anyway. We could pitch it as the reverse hitch. Like it has an elevator pitch already. And it's you or some fictionalized version of you. And Chris Hemsworth's the other guy, or whoever is the other guy. Michael B. Jordan is the other guy.
Michael B. Jordan and Kevin James.
Yeah. Perfect.
Yeah. The sequel is just
probably
Kevin
not
James.
Kevin James.
You could say Kevin James.
Yeah. Kevin James has evolved and now he's just the expert.
Things didn't work out with Allegra Cole. Then he became a womanizer out of depression from not working out with Allegra. And then he became Hitch.
I'd watch that. And you get the cameo from Will Smith at the end when he walks in and, you know, Will Smith is happily married and he's a grandfather now. And
yeah. And it's like, and then reminds Kevin James how to love again. And then Kevin James at the end of the movie realizes that he's not as happy as he used to be, even though he can talk to women the way that Hitch usually could. And then he found somebody. And then, of course, in the movie, when he finally finds the person that he loves, like he loved Allegra, like he forgets how to hit on women again. And then Hitch comes at the end and like helps like him seal the deal again. Look at this.
Ari, we're going to lose you. I know this. We're going to lose you. You're going to be cranking out made for Netflix movies.
When's the last time a really good comedy movie came out? Like, what are your favorite comedies of all time? Like, I'm sure you've done a random ranking before.
I have not. I don't know that I've done a random ranking of it, but so the usual, like, Caddyshack, Animal House. I think The Hangover is probably the most recent truly great comedy.
Yeah, and what year was that? 2013?
2009?
Was it 9?
2008?
So, like, to me, my favorite comedy movies are probably the same as everybody listening to this. Forgetting Sarah Marshall, Superbad, Old School, Step Brothers, all those
all
movies.
Good, all good, all good.
When's the last time they made a movie like that?
It's been a while. Now, they've tried to make a few. They had, like, Blockers and a couple other, you know, teen comedy types like Superbad or Can't Hardly Wait or that type of movie. But
it's because it's just the humor isn't acceptable anymore.
There was a good run in the mid, like in the early aughts in the mids, where you had, you know, The Hangover, you had Superbad, you had 40-Year-Old Virgin. Those were...
Yeah, they don't make those
Anchorman.
That's what I'm saying, though. They don't make any of those. It's because if you go back and watch them now unedited, it wouldn't be socially correct, so they won't make them anymore.
Well, and they also, because we're less likely to watch them in a theater, because a lot of that is group dynamics. Like, I remember seeing, so my son was born in August 2009, so The Hangover was the last movie I saw in a theater for a long, long time. And it was one of those where everybody was laughing so hard, and you're laughing even harder because everybody else is laughing like that.
And every single movie that comes out is like some weird Sandra Bullock, Channing Tatum movie, or like some weird, like The Rock movie. And it's just like, those people aren't, well, let's get the funny people back into doing the funny movies. And it's like, if you go back and you watch Superbad, and then Chris Vanini sent me an article about this.
Nobody knew who Jonah Hill was. Nobody knew who Emma Watson, she became a massive star. Now I'm blanking on her name.
Emma Stone.
Yes. But nobody knew who she was. And nobody knew the kid who played McLovin, but he's been in a ton of comedy since. Like, they just knew those people were funny. That was the whole Seth Rogen
crew. I just don't think
that,
like, Sandra Bullock is a tremendous actor and she's in a lot of really good movies. That's not what we're talking about here. And, like, even Dumb and Dumber 2 was awful.
Oh,
so terrible. Like, it's just, I just, like, wish they would make the genre anymore. And Chris sent me a story in The Ringer saying that every studio now is competing to make blockbuster hits because those, like, comedies that we're all obsessed with, like Step Brothers and Superbad, don't make as much money as a comic book movie does. Which is why you have Spider-Man 48, you know, instead of, like, really good comedies.
Right, because that movie costs a lot to make. That Spider-Man movie costs a ton to make, but you know it's going to make two or three times as much as you paid for it.
I know, but don't comedies cost way less to make and do just as well? Like, you're
telling
me
the ones that do well, but
Step Brothers.
But most of them bomb because it's hard to be funny.
I know. And they keep making these movies that aren't funny and putting them, like, it's just a shame. It's been a good 7 or 8 years since they've made a tremendously good comedy classic.
Yeah. And I think I would love that. The mid budget movie has died. And that's what those comedies are. They're mid budget.
And the comedy is no longer socially acceptable. Like, you can't say the words and the jokes that they say in a lot of those movies anymore just because it's kind of like in that era now, which, for right or wrong, that's just the way it is.
Well, so I watched The Hangover and there were a couple lines in there where I'm like, oh, I don't think you could say that right now.
There's like movies where the entire premise of the movie couldn't exist right now. It's like, I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry is not an acceptable movie to make.
Very, very, very bad things. Probably not. Yeah. Even though it's a dark comedy. It's supposed to be very dark. So,
yeah. It's just like, it's a society has changed. That's all. And, you know, this isn't a political discussion about whether you're into it or you're not. It's just the reality of why they don't make them.
Well, Ari, you and I are going to get together. We're going to create the script of the next great comedy or possibly Hitch 2. And we're going to make this happen. We'll find the right people and make this happen.
Yeah. I mean, I have a good friend who works at NBC who is in the writing. I think he like is a part of who approves shows, and it's just a really hard job. So
it is.
He'll have to help us out.
We can do this. Sorry. Hey, Athletic, we've enjoyed working for you, but we're going to Hollywood. We're going to be screenwriters.
Does that mean I finally get to live in Laguna?
I mean, if you're good at it.
Yeah. Step one. One bedroom shack.
Let's get Hitch 2 to the development stage and then we'll figure this out. Until then, we'll keep podcasting. We got Room Temperature Takes with Max Olson coming up on Tuesday. Very special interview on Wednesday. Former Iowa State quarterback Brock Purdy. And by the way, if you would like to subscribe to The Athletic, you can get it for $1 per month for your first 6 months. TheAthletic.com/AndySTaples. Ari, it's been a pleasure. Let's get to work on our screenplay.